help to make the season bright. Tiny tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight.
What's your name?
They know that Santa's
Where's your mommy?
He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh.
Shh.
And every mother's child is gonna spy.
Hello, welcome to the Extra Credits Plus of Steven Spielberg's Catch Me If You Can. I'm Trey.
And I'm Kelsey.
Today we are talking about one of the most entertaining films of the 21st century. I think one of the most thrilling movies in Spielberg's filmography.
Yeah.
And I realized on rewatch the other night that I might have to reopen our Spielberg ranking conversation toward the end of today's episode, because I think I might place this elsewhere than where I did last year.
Interesting. Okay, I'm down to share my top five, top 10.
Let's do it.
At the end of the pod.
All 34.
I don't know if this has changed. No way. I don't know if this has changed for me in terms of where I put Catch Me If You Can, but I definitely have different feelings than I did a year ago. I think because I was watching this movie for the first time to talk about it for like 2 hours, right?
Right,
so yeah. I have a different perspective that I'm really excited to get into today. And I'm just so excited that the patrons, our listeners, picked this movie for our holiday episode.
Yes, so they voted for this film for our Christmas episode. They also voted for Paul Thomas Anderson's Phantom Thread for the New Year's episode. So they aren't messing around. Our listeners are picking the most important American filmmakers us to talk about. Great
Phantom
taste,
Thread.
Lot of pressure. I'm excited, like genuinely excited to talk about Catch Me If You Can, because it is a movie I really enjoy watching. I'm also relieved to deep dive a film like this, because we've had such thematic heavyweights on Patreon lately, like recently with Blade Runner and before that Alien. And I think outside of Jurassic Park and Jaws, Catch Me If You Can is one of his most stylish, entertaining films that is fun to talk about and not as challenging, right? Textually.
Yeah.
So that's nice at the very least, because Blade Runner was a lot.
Yeah, I mean, not just Ridley's movies. Our last Patreon episodes have been Fincher's, like Social Network, Zodiac, and then we had Midsommar before that, and Scorsese, Goodfellas, and Wolf of Wall Street.
Insane.
Yeah, we've been doing a lot of films with dense thematic texts and a lot of different opinions in terms of criticism and also just public perception, right? A lot of people disagree on, like, Wolf of Wall Street, for example.
Yeah.
So it is nice to feel like we're slowing down with Catch Me If You Can for a minute here. But also, I think that Catch Me If You Can is really interesting to talk about in terms of Spielberg's filmography.
Yes.
And he said, like, he made this to be a fun movie, but it kind of encapsulates a lot of his project, right? We're always interested in what directors are continuously asking as a question in their work, and like why they choose certain projects. And Catch Me If You Can has a lot of those reoccurring ideas of family and connection and like child of divorce, and how does someone's upbringing influence their emotional connections later on.
Yeah.
And also, I know he's made an actual Peter Pan movie like Hook, but this is kind of his real life Peter Pan movie, right? Like the idea of never growing up that he also has in a lot of his movies.
I love the idea of a double feature of Hook and Catch Me If You Can. I was going to make the argument that people should double feature The Fablemans and Catch Me If You Can, because they seem like they're talking with one another.
I agree with that. There's a lot of, Leo's character, Frank.
Yeah.
And Sam.
Yeah, Sammy Fableman.
Yep.
Yep. That's the one. So we've talked about Spielberg before on our show, obviously, just from our Fableman joke a second ago, especially recently on our Scorsese and Scott deep dives. We explored a bit of the 70s up and coming filmmakers who made like a real name for themselves through the 80s and 90s. We talked a lot about, I think on the Napoleon episode, about Scorsese and Scott and James Cameron and now Spielberg. And I think specifically Scorsese, Scott, and Spielberg, to me, are in a tier by themselves of like prolific mainstream filmmaking. And I think we personally are fans of Ridley Scott. You know, we've been very outspoken lately about that. And also Martin Scorsese out of that group specifically. And I think we appreciate how they've pushed conventions throughout their career and They've kind of increased expectations always through Hollywood of grittier, more flawed human movies that are more in our lane. And they have some misses, definitely Ridley Scott does. But I think those two make really transgressive studio movies accessible to a lot of audiences during eras that they could have just cashed out. Sometimes they did. Again, Ridley Scott.
Yeah.
They had their moments, but those are our favorites of that, of the kind of like core four from the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But Spielberg is so many people's favorite director.
Yeah.
And this is really, I think, our first serious opportunity at discussing and exploring what it is about his movies that makes him so universally beloved. So I'm excited to get into his work today outside of just this film.
Yeah. I mean, do you want to talk about that now or do you want to save it for when we get into the movie?
I'd rather talk about specific films when we get into the movie.
Okay.
Because I think it'll be fun to connect this movie to a lot of other films in his filmography.
Yeah.
I think we could talk about Spielberg for a second, like what we appreciate and admire about his mission.
Yeah. Well, I just thought it was interesting that you said he is probably the most beloved widely out of that cohort of auteurs.
Yeah.
And I think it does have something to do with that he is making movies that are certainly like diverse. He has so many different plots and different themes too that he is interested in his filmography, but he does make a lot of movies with sentimental endings and tones.
Optimistic.
Yeah. So I think he is appealing to a broader audience, and that's not necessarily a hit. Like that is one of the reasons that he isn't my favorite. Because I like a little bit of, I like a little bit of darkness.
Yeah. He's got some of those and they're very effective. Yeah.
But I do think that that has something to do with it, right? Like Catch Me If You Can, such a fun movie from start to finish. Like, but I found myself as I was watching it, and I don't know if it's the Leo of it all or the con man of it all, but thinking about Wolf of Wall Street and they are actually about like kind of similar things.
Yeah.
And there are some thematic differences, obviously, but just how the stories are told differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I prefer something a little bit more punchy.
Yeah.
But I do think though, like going back on this, like in terms of Spielberg's project, I do admire the kind of like blockbuster that he's trying to capture in all of his movies.
Yes, I agree. I think when I think American filmmaker, I think Steven Spielberg for everything that you just said. So for better and for worse. And I think he is both an entertaining populist, which is what you're getting to. And sometimes in that populism, he can hold standards higher for blockbuster filmmaking. So that is interesting. And then sometimes he can even be a pushy filmmaker, which I respect because there are moments in his filmography where he pushes harder than usual. And even if I don't agree with everything he's doing, I still admire him for that. And some of those films I think are masterpieces. Like when we get to Schindler's List later today, I'm sure we'll talk about it. But I think people really adore Spielberg because he tends to create these universally transfixing, immersive, emotionally gripping, entertaining projects. And it still feels like he has a film out all the time. Like there's always a Spielberg movie out. You can rely on him. I mean, he's getting older now and I hope he continues making movies at a high rate, but it feels like he'll come out with a movie sometimes twice in 1 year and he still accomplishes those high bars that the audience has for him. And so he's such a serious talent and he has such a great feel for tone and understands set pieces so well. He captures an audience with like subtle compositions, camera choices, one of the best blocking directors in film history. And he seems to like really deeply understand how to make emotion cinematic where most filmmakers would make it corny. And he can be corny. Like Spielberg can be nerdy and he can be corny. He has his moments.
Yes.
And we've been critical of him in the past.
We'll talk about it today.
For sure. But there is something about how he, I mean, obviously his personal experience has a lot to do with this, but how he approaches broken families and how he also brings that same passion through war spectacles or coming of age journeys. And really whatever the genre, he still finds a way to assemble the crew around him to make his sensibilities commercial. And he brings this witty, childlike humor to even his darkest work. And sometimes it's playful and sometimes that can feel misplaced in moments too.
Yeah, I think we will definitely talk about that today, even in Catch Me If You Can, that seems like it has no stakes, right? But ultimately, I think you're right that Spielberg is special because he's able to capture so much emotion on screen.
Mm-hmm.
I think of a lot of scenes in his movies when I think of his work that are kind of like goosebump cinematic moments, right? Yeah. Like I think of the Jaws scene of zooming in on Officer Brody on the beach, or the first time you see the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park, or Elliot and E.T. on their bike in the sky. You know, there are so many moments that are important to American film iconography and so many moments that are important to people. Like when I say E.T., a lot of people, this sounds like corny, but it feels like a light goes on inside of them, right?
Yeah,
that's special to see people have such a huge relationship to his movies.
Yeah, I wonder if it's because he has also been so dynamic and versatile in what genres he's playing in. I mean, he's tackling different angles of subject matter across five decades of storytelling, whether it's through science fiction, like you're saying with E.T., or Close Encounters of the Third Kind, to then adventure in Indiana Jones, or historical dramas in Schindler's List, or Saving Private Ryan, or The Color Purple, or spectacles with Jurassic Park and Jaws. There's just so many hugely successful blockbusters with usually broad appeal that are visually stunning and can have like high concept ideas running through them. And I think he's kind of viewed as this singular summer blockbuster filmmaker because he kind of creates the summer blockbuster with Jaws. I mean, that's how innovative he was in his career. He's also hired some of the best special effects pioneers like in the business. And he's hired people who have revolutionized the industry, who've set new standards in visual storytelling. And he still is able to keep that kind of like Spielbergian human spirit triumph. And I think there is, and maybe that's also where I'm out on him. And I guess we can talk about that quickly before we go to Catch Me If You Can, because I do think there is a recognizable sensitivity or sensitive pathos that he has like commercialized at the highest of levels. And so I tend to find myself in a lot of his work emotionally and sometimes intellectually checking out when Spielberg finds this tragic optimism or tragic optimistic approach in a lot of his narratives. And I still admire at the end of his films how big they were and how approachable they were and universal. But I think in other filmmakers' hands that I love, they can be a little bit more challenging in movies like what he makes. And that's why my favorites are the most like provocative, but also universal.
Yeah, I wouldn't go as far to say that all of his movies kind of end with the title card and everyone lived happily ever after.
No.
Like, there is, though, a sense of like, I think I use this term on our Spielberg draft, but there is a sense of like rose-colored glasses. Like, there is sometimes off-putting, for me personally, optimistic tones when it feels like, wait, but it doesn't feel like everything should be okay. Like, I think it's okay to end something with a little bit of a
more flawed human approach. I feel like there is something he tries to do where he resolves his films with the inherent goodness of people and like how people are ultimately good in their cores. And what ruins society is like corrupt governments, like that's, or business, you know, in Jurassic Park, whatever it is. So I feel like even though I appreciate and admire his filmography and I even love a few of his films, I do think in Catch Me If You Can, it's pretty clear that he has a very idealized vision on the world as a whole. And I do appreciate that vision, though, because it is pretty consistent. And I do think it is a vision that changes politically with the times. And I think he's keeping the heart through all of his eras while intellectually adapting to the moment. And I think that is commendable. So all of those dynamics, I think, collectively contribute to his influence and status and what you're talking about his role in like American iconography. He's like the ultimate water cooler American filmmaker.
Yeah.
People at their jobs talking about their favorite movies that they've seen in their lives. And I think really his name is in the cultural consciousness, probably even more than a Martin Scorsese, which is pretty wild if you think about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that is really interesting. And I don't think, well, I guess we'll get into this more today as we talk about his films in more detail, but I think that even in films where you could argue like Saving Private Ryan, right, does have a commentary at the end that isn't necessarily optimistic, but he still has heroic figures that then make it optimistic. And I think like that's where I am kind of out on some of his movies. And so, I'm just excited to talk about that more today. I'm also excited to talk about Catch Me If You Can.
Yeah. I'm also excited to talk about this stacked cast in Catch Me If You Can. This is probably the first Leo movie I saw as a kid. And DiCaprio is just incredible in this. He is like mischief personified in this movie. He is so instinctive. He is physically expressive at like an all-time high. It's probably in my top three Leo performances. So maybe we could talk about that today too.
Okay.
We can discuss that a little bit later. It's just really fun to watch him as Frank Jr. like artfully slip in and out of situations, kind of playing into this fragile boy archetype while also playing into this maybe sociopath disguised as like a passing innocent white man. And we'll get into like what is successful, maybe probably unexplored about that latter idea, especially with race. But outside of that Frank Jr. on the page, I think Leo is just so iconic in this movie. He's excelling at owning the screen and really entertaining as the kind of like worst and best of this person. And he's playing both this like teenager that you feel empathy for while also playing this imposter who like before his 19th birthday impersonates pilots, doctors, lawyers, and maybe not in real life, but he like is making millions of dollars as this fictionalized Frank, because there is a, we can get into it more later, but I haven't mentioned it yet, but ironically, the real life Frank Abagnale has been investigated over the past few decades by like a lot of investigators, reporters, and most of his claims have been disproved.
Interesting.
Which is hilarious to think that like Abagnale tricked Hollywood and the world into him thinking that
he wrote
like
a book, right?
He wrote a book in 1980. We'll get into it. He wrote a book in 1980 that is like his autobiography. And I think Spielberg probably had an inclination of some of it being bullshit because he kind of takes that book and then he starts kind of adding in all these familial tensions that we grow accustomed to with Spielberg films, like this father love story, this mother hate story. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's an interesting double feature with something like The Fabelmans. And so this movie, I look at as more of an exploration of Steven Spielberg's psyche with interesting themes and interesting characters, rather than like buying too much into the, was this a real con man or not? Because apparently it just, it really wasn't.
Yeah, which is hilarious because I've seen that too, that a lot of the real life Frank Abagnale stories of working as a pilot and a lawyer and a doctor in the capacity that he says he did was actually debunked. And yet there's like a five-part miniseries on the DVD behind the scenes of him talking about how tricked everyone. Yeah, and him going on like Jimmy Carson and people applauding him.
Yeah.
And so I actually think that there's something to talk about here in our conversation that's a little bit more sinister in the collective like applause of this idea of this like charismatic leader and this kid like getting away with all these different things.
Yeah.
There's something a little bit more like slimy going on than is depicted in Catch Me If You Can. And I think that in terms of the filmmaker, like you're saying, Spielberg found an in on this, like he said this, through the family story, through the character arc, through the idea of like faking it till you make it in Hollywood with his own career.
Yeah, when he was a 16-year-old walking on studio lots. Like, I think he saw himself in that kind of character.
Yeah, he told those stories in the kind of press run for The Fabelmans.
Yeah. All right, so Catch Me If You Can. As always, our Extra Credits Plus episodes are deep dives, but they are also live commentaries, so we will be discussing Catch Me If You Can while watching it. And if you're on the main feed, that means you're listening to the first 30 minutes of this episode. So if you go into the description, you'll find our Patreon, the Extra Credits Plus, where you can join us on Living Plus to get access to the full 2 to 3 hour deep dives we publish on there, as well as the 3 episodes we cover each new month. Right now, listeners are voting for one of our 3 January episodes. They are picking from some of our favorite Best Picture winners of all time. We saved some for future miniseries this year, upcoming year in 2024, but it looks like it will either be The Silence of the Lambs, The Departed, No Country for Old Men, Spotlight, or Moonlight.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I would be down to do any of those. Everyone, don't forget to vote for our next month's episode.
Yeah, I'm excited. Also, for any listeners who want to listen and watch along to Catch Me If You Can, you can stream the movie right now on Netflix, though I think with their new family plan rollout, that seems impossible for many of us. so you can just own Catch Me If You Can on Blu-ray. We own a pretty sick steelbook that I recommend. All right. You ready to hear this John Williams score?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's do this. I'm not going to do it with you. Yeah. Okay. I'm too tone deaf. All right. 3, 2, 1, play. So I thought I'd start today's episode with this wild pre-production note.
Okay.
So Catch Me If You Can's adapted screenplay comes from obviously the semi-fictionalized retelling of Frank Jr.'s, I guess, not true story, his right. fabricated autobiography. But the rights to the screenplay was sold between several studios over 2 decades. And okay. at one point, only 2 years before the film was made by Spielberg in 2002, David Fincher was hired to make this movie and pivoted wow. last second to Panic Room, or at least that's how the story goes. And I'm just imagining, since finding that out yesterday, how twisted his vision
yeah.
of Frank Jr. would be.
What like, do you what think film, it would... I was just going to say, what do like you think Fight Club? It would be like? I think killer.
We're probably both killer. Wrong. It's probably something more John Hughes, like Fincher called The Social Network his John Hughes-like movie.
Oh, interesting.
So
yeah.
it would probably be like The Network, yeah.
Yeah, I think Social Network, though, is interesting because that's a story about, right, Mark Zuckerberg, fictionalized, but mm-hmm. the Jesse Eisenberg character there wants to have charisma, right? Like, he yeah. wants to be like Justin Timberlake
yeah.
in the movie. And
that's a well-examined...
just wants to be liked. Where in this yeah. movie, it's more so Leo's character has that charismatic quality that makes everyone believe what he's saying and makes everyone mm-hmm. pay attention to him. And so I feel like those are... they're about like similar things, but ultimately like right. I wonder how he would approach this. Obviously it'd be way darker.
Well, Spielberg is convincing at showing us different ways that people can find connection that isn't necessarily through like bloodlines in this mm-hmm. movie, like between Carl and Frank Jr. And David Fincher is convincing at telling us that men are so fragile that they'll ruin everyone's connections yeah. if they don't get what they want and don't get unconditional love. So it would have been quite the film, but I think we already got it. So
yeah,
right now we're getting the opening to Catch Me If You Can and the very unique John Williams score and this very singular, I think pretty distinct Spielberg opening design oh, yeah. too. Like this is as much artifice as I've ever seen from a Spielberg movie. I recommend listeners who aren't watching along to check out the opening again on YouTube while we're talking here, because it looks like the beginning of an old James Bond film or a television show.
Yeah.
It's kind of corny, but also pretty cool. It's like very Pink Panther or James Bond or something like that.
Yeah, I think it works. I can understand why someone might not be into it, but yeah. I think it's cool. I think the John Williams score helps a lot.
It's incredible.
Also feels very distinct from Spielberg's filmography, like the kind of jazzy score yeah. that Williams has here.
Well, he's usually like he's known for Jaws and Star Wars and Indiana Jones and Jurassic Park. And we probably know him best for the 3 Harry Potter films he worked mm-hmm. on, like really focusing on that magical tone and wonder before the Harry Potter films turn into dark, gritty nightmares that we love so much. Right. And the scores go to like Alexandre Desplat and 7 and 8, which are so great. But Williams is so fantastic in this film, you're right, and so distinctive because of that jazzy, unsettled, upbeat atmosphere that he really creates through the music.
Yeah, and as we get into the movie, I want to talk about the interviews that I watched of John Williams talking about how he connected this movie thematically. So like yeah. when Frank calls Carl on Christmas, he plays the dad, like the Frank Abagnale Sr. music.
Okay.
So there's kind of like this connection to his father yeah. and lack of connection when he calls Hanratty on Christmas.
I guess that makes sense because Carl is supposed to be like that found father figure that he never had in his later teen years when he ran away.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I really enjoy the Williams score. So hopefully we can keep bringing that up because again, we sit on every Patreon podcast, but we don't listen to the movies. So it's kind of hard to time out those conversations yeah. on Williams, but it is very lively. It's playful. What I also like about the score is it comes in with like devastating moments too. And so it has this real emotional volatility that I think the movie tries to match, but I think the score does a lot of the legwork for a yeah. lot of like Spielberg's character studies here. It really gives a language to the film. Right now we're watching the game show introduction, which I wasn't familiar with this game show before seeing this film. It's called To Tell the Truth, which again ran in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an interesting narrative choice because usually in films that jump between different timelines, there is usually like an opening crawl telling you about the lead character, telling you about like the infamous conflict that's going to happen in the movie. And instead in this film, we have the game show host explain to us like this character of Frank Abagnale Jr., who is this outrageous imposter who for 3 years impersonated an airline pilot, impersonated a pediatrician, an assistant attorney general. And so I kind of enjoyed this different type of opening.
Yeah. Or we'll usually get dropped into the story immediately and kind of figure it out. But yeah, I thought it was like an interesting, unique opening that worked also because the movie has a lot to do with the spectacle too.
Yeah.
Like there's a kind of attraction, I think, from the audience of how Frank is getting away with all of these things, right? Mm-hmm. Because they seem like pretty difficult things to get away with.
Right.
Which we talked about.
So, like, so difficult
actually
that
probably were.
We're actually impossible.
But I think there's like something in this, and one of my favorite scenes is when he like tells the high school girl that his classmate to fold the note.
That's
fake doctor's note.
The creases,
and I think there's like something about that here that an opening in a game show style, he's mm-hmm. like telling us there's like a spectacle around this story before we even start.
I'm not even sure the movie knows whether it is that aware of if it is telling a cautionary tale versus like this romanticization of this character, Frank Jr. So I do think that the game show opening is a unique opening, but I don't know if it totally actually fits with the through line at the end of the film, which obviously we'll get to. Right now, we're being opened up to the new character, Carl Hanratty, who is an FBI agent who we'll get to in a second. He's the Tom Hanks character. And I want to explain the two parallel timelines that we have running through this movie because it can be a confusing watch for a first time watch for a lot of listeners. So we start off with the game show in 1977. We don't really go back there until the end of the film, I believe. But this the two timelines, the lead timelines here is we have our lead characters in 1969 on screen right now in France on Christmas Eve. Carl Hanratty is visiting adult Frank Abagnale Jr. in a French jail. And we'll eventually cut back to our other timeline in 1963, where most of the movie takes place with a young teenage Frank Abagnale Jr.
Yeah.
And it does get confusing because all the movie really tries to do to show you the different timeline without showing you the years is put like facial hair on Leo or long hair.
Yeah. I think he does do a good job in kind of changing the tone of his voice to
that's
show,
true. Yeah.
You know, that he is getting older. But ultimately, you're right. They're like, let's just put a wig on him. But it is ultimately a little confusing what point we're at as we have these two, you know, narrative timelines that we're going doing flashbacks. And then now we're in the future where he's in jail, you know, and because Leo just looks young.
Yeah. Yeah. So right now, Tom Hanks is kind of admiring that Frank is escaped through the jail, which is pretty funny that he's like not. It really sets up these characters well because we learn that Frank is an imposter, obviously, but we also learn that Carl is overly sympathetic to this figure, which is going to be the Spielberg problem of the film too, which it feels like the director is overly sympathetic with this character creation.
Yeah, well, even like before we get away from the game show, there's a behind the scenes clip of Frank Abagnale, the real Frank Abagnale, on a Jimmy Carson a talk show. And it has all these people like applauding him.
Mm-hmm.
And something that I want to talk to you about as we go throughout this, because Tom Hanks's character is so sympathetic towards the Leo character, towards Frank, is that the audience, is that like Spielberg saying that we should also be sympathetic? Is that Spielberg as the Tom Hanks character being sympathetic?
So
right?
That's interesting.
I don't know how far he's interrogating this idea of, oh, well, Leo was just a kid, you know? And when I say Leo, I'm just going to, you know, use that interchangeably. Sure.
But that's fascinating because Carl Hanratty is actually not a real FBI agent. He is a composite of several agents who were assigned to Frank's case. Mm-hmm. And he really operates as like what we've been saying, the found father figure. But I love this meta idea of it being a stand in for Spielberg's interpretation of this story, but also the more kind of like just narrative basic idea of him being a surrogate for the audience about whether or not we should sympathize.
Yeah.
Or even some people empathize, I guess, with Frank Abagnale Jr. I do think that is an underdeveloped idea.
Well, it's connected. It's connected to this scene that we're seeing now with the dad giving this mice bucket of cream.
Yes.
Right. Story. Like,
it's such a bad story. Oh my God.
Like, is Frank the mouse who makes butter out of the cream?
Okay.
You know, like, what is it?
Hi.
Hello there. Sorry for interrupting.
Yeah. Thank you for listening so far. And hopefully you are enjoying the episode so far. I feel like maybe if you made it this far.
They got it this far. They're having a good time.
I mean, let's hope. But to access our full conversation, you can go to the description of this episode to join our Patreon community, the Extra Credits Plus.
Yes. And for only $5 a month, you can get access to our full catalog of Patreon exclusive episodes. Hope to see you there.